Good afternoon. The Labor, Industry, Veterans Affairs, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. I would like to announce that this meeting will take place in accordance with House Rule 1001. This meeting may be viewed on House Public Information TV, which is available on the House website. As is custom with this committee, please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Before we get started, our committee legislative assistant, Kevin Petry, will take the roll call.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Zhang, present. Representative Detmer.
Detmer, present.
Representative Detmer, present. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, present.
Representative McDonald, present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Representative Berg, present.
I am.
Representative Bliss.
Representative Bliss, present.
Representative Bliss, present. Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Frederick, present. Representative Greenman.
Present.
Representative Greenman, present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson, present.
Representative Nelson, present. Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Poston, present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Raleigh, present. Representative Sundin.
Present.
Representative Sundin, present. And Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
All right, a quorum is present. Next on the agenda is approval of minutes from February 15, 2020. Do I have a motion for approval?
This is Representative Raleigh. So moved, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Raleigh. Representative Raleigh moves the minutes from February 15, 2022. Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favors, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right, the minutes are adopted. All right, members, we have a unique situation today. We have a presentation and one bill on the agenda today. Chair Eklund is presenting his bill in another committee right now. But we'll start with a presentation. Looks like from Commissioner Roslyn Robertson from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. We have her here.
Excuse me, Vice Chair Zhang. I believe we have House File 999.
Oh, House. Okay, yeah, by Representative Schultz. Okay, I see here. Let me just pull up the correct number here. Okay. Welcome, Representative Schultz. I see you here. Would you like to introduce, I see House File 999. I will move that House File 999 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. Welcome, Representative Schultz. Please introduce your bill.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair Zhang and members. House File 999 is a bill that limits the use of non-compete agreements. These are covenants not to compete. And what that means, it's an employment agreement that restricts an employee's ability to work for another employer after their termination for a certain time period in a certain geographic area or in a similar capacity. So what this bill does, it limits these non-compete agreements, which have become much more common, particularly in low-wage occupations. And this bill tries to not eliminate the use of non-competes, but just limits their use. Many states are introducing similar legislation, and states like North Dakota and Oklahoma and California have eliminated the use of these non-compete agreements. Non-compete agreements lead to a lot of negative externalities, and as an economist, I'm really interested in trying to eliminate these externalities, such as job lock. Research suggests that in states that use these, there are lower wages, it reduces entrepreneurship, it leads to inefficient job sorting, wasteful litigation. And with our workforce shortages, we really need right now flexibility and job mobility. It also can waste the training of individuals who are training for specific occupations. And if they sign a non-compete agreement and want to leave, that employer may not be able to work in that same occupation with those skills. So it could be wasteful training and very inefficient. So I have some exceptional testifiers with us today, and I'm eager to get to their testimony. First, we have a video from the Attorney General. I know our Attorney General's office is very interested in pursuing these types of agreements and limiting them. And then we have Professor Evan Starr, who's a national expert on non-compete agreements and has done some research, which he will share. And then Ryan Nunn from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis also has done some research on non-compete. So eager to get to their testimony, and then I'll have some closing comments. Chair Zhang.
All right, thank you, Representative Schultz. So we will hear from Keith Ellison, Attorney General of the State of Minnesota.
Chair Eklund and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for accepting my pre-recorded testimony. It's so essential that I share the views of the Attorney General's office with you, and this is the only way to do it given the challenges of the schedule. I'm sorry I'm not able to be with you live. That is always my preference, but I'm happy to share with you why I support House File 999. My job as Attorney General is to help people afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. As we all know, it's tough to afford your life these days. When your employer arbitrarily and unnecessarily limits your ability to get a new job, maybe one with higher pay, better benefits, and working conditions, affording your life gets much, much harder. And this is especially true if you work for low wages. But this is what the non-compete clauses in employment contracts actually do. They suppress wages, they limit freedom, they stifle innovation, they undermine the market. Frankly, non-compete clauses stack the deck against workers, especially low-wage workers. Non-compete clauses do a lot of harm and very little good. They prevent employees from leaving one job for a better one. They prevent employees from leaving a business and starting their own. Through non-compete clauses, employers have found and bound a wide range of workers, from baristas to journalists to auto mechanics to sandwich makers, and deprived them of the freedom to work where they choose. Research suggests that non-competes currently shackle as many as 1 in 5 American workers, 20%. The position of the Attorney General's office is that when it comes to low-wage workers in Minnesota, non-compete contracts are invalid and unenforceable. Our position is supported by case law that the state courts have made. Beyond Minnesota borders, I led a group of 19 attorneys general from around the country in urging the Federal Trade Commission to make rules to outlaw non-compete clauses for low-wage workers. Stopping non-compete agreements from restricting low-wage Minnesotans' opportunities, which HF 999 does, is a good first step toward eradicating their use in Minnesota. But if House File 999 doesn't only protect low-wage workers, it also protects Minnesotans who can earn higher wages. Under the bill, employers who invoke a non-compete on people who earn more than the median income for a family of four would be required to pay, quote, garden leave, unquote, for invoking the non-compete clause. Garden leave means an employer would have to compensate an employee who can't work because of a non-compete clause with at least 50% of her annual wages. It ensures that an employer cannot use a non-compete to inappropriately stifle innovation and competition in the workplace and in the marketplace as well, to the detriment of competition and to workers. Non-compete clauses don't just hurt workers. They also hurt the businesses that would benefit from hiring away talented workers whose current employers aren't able to promote them or aren't doing enough to retain them. A dominant firm can even use them to lock up the talent pool and starve its competition of high-quality employees. It's clear from the prevalence of non-compete clauses that employers aren't just using them to protect confidential information and their investments in workers. Employers require non-compete clauses to make it impossible for workers to leave. Non-compete clauses are anti-competitive, anti-innovation, anti-worker, and anti-free market. What's worse, non-compete agreements are almost entirely unnecessary. If employers want to protect their investment in workers, they can incentivize them to stay, not punish them if they leave. Employers can offer term contracts with job security for their workers, and they can offer raises, promotions, and better working conditions to retain staff and protect their own interests. I also want to be clear that limiting non-compete agreements does not hurt employers. Employers already have tools for protecting their own interests. They can use non-disclosure agreements, appropriate and tailored non-compete agreements, and other less restrictive covenants, as well as trade secret laws that already exist to protect their interests. Your employer should not be able to limit your freedom to find the best job for yourself and your family that helps you afford your life and helps your family get ahead, especially if you're a low-wage worker. House File 999 is just good common sense and would codify what Minnesota courts already have found. I urge you to support it. I certainly do.
All right. Thank you to the Attorney General's office. Next, we have Evan Starr, Assistant Professor of Management and Organization. Is Evan Starr present?
Present, yes.
All right.
All right. Thank you so much. Good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and the members of the committee for the opportunity to testify regarding House File 999. My name is Evan Starr. I'm an associate professor at the University of Maryland at the Robert H. Smith School of Business. And over the last decade, I've been studying the use and impact of non-compete clauses and the effects of various approaches to regulating them. I published more than a dozen articles about non-competes and other restrictive covenants. And today I want to briefly summarize this research and then discuss several common concerns with bills of this nature. First, nationally, non-competes cover between 15% and 28% of U.S. workers, and 30% of firms use non-compete agreements for all workers within the firm without regard to job title or job duties. According to one nationally representative study, hourly paid workers actually make up the majority of those bound by non-compete agreements. Second, only 10% of non-compete bound workers report negotiating over the terms of the non-compete or in exchange for other benefits. And employers regularly compel workers to sign non-competes when the worker has limited bargaining power, such as on the first day of the job. Third, despite competing theoretical arguments, most research suggests that the use and enforceability of non-competes reduces wages, entrepreneurship, and job-to-job mobility, making it harder for firms to hire. As Representative Schultz mentioned, these losses also spill over to those not bound by non-compete agreements and also into neighboring labor markets. Fourth, even in states where non-competes are per se enforceable, non-competes are also still used, covering between 19% and 23% of workers, and they still chill employee mobility. Fifth, as AG Ellison remarked, other tools such as non-disclosure agreements or trade secret laws can do similar jobs for the firm without directly constraining worker options so severely. So the efficacy of non-competes should be judged based on their marginal value relative to these less restrictive alternatives. Finally, I'd like to address three common concerns related to bills like this. One natural concern is that firms, especially small firms, might be unfairly hurt if workers can walk across the street and compete. And I think this worker versus firm perspective overlooks that non-competes are just one among many ways to protect valuable information or investments, and it ignores the fact that firms are on both sides of this equation. Firms may not want to lose workers to competitors, but they gain the ability to hire from them too. As it pertains to small firms, the research suggests that not only does enforcing non-competes prevent new firms from starting, It also prevents them from growing and disadvantages them relative to their larger incumbents. A second concern is what the right threshold is for low-wage workers and whether it is too high. States have taken varying approaches here, including the median income of family of four, as was done in Oregon in 2008. And some of my preliminary research suggests that thresholds up to and exceeding $100,000 per year are in fact reasonable. A final concern is that regulating non-competes is a partisan issue. Now, without a doubt, limiting the enforceability of non-competes is not a partisan issue. Joining California is the only states where non-competes are outright unenforceable are Oklahoma and North Dakota. Right now, there is legislation moving forward to ban low-wage non-competes in Iowa and West Virginia, as well as in many other states, and there are bipartisan and bicameral bills being considered in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here today to speak on behalf of House File 999. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right, thank you, Mr. Starr. Sorry about that. Assistant Professor of Management and Organization, University of Maryland, Robert H. School of Business. So I apologize, I didn't complete the title. Next, we have Ryan Nunn, Assistant Vice President for Applied Research, the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis.
Present.
All right. Mr. Nunn, please proceed.
Thank you and good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to testify regarding HF 999. My name is Ryan Nunn. I'm the Assistant Vice President for Applied Research in Community Development here at the Minneapolis Fed. I'm an economist with a focus on analysis of labor market institutions, including non-compete contracts, which I've worked on at the U.S. Treasury Department, the Brookings Institution, and now at the Minneapolis Fed. But the views I express today are my own and not necessarily those of the Minneapolis Fed. I'll begin by noting, as Professor Starr just said, that many more workers have non-competes than we once believed. I think this includes workers with lower wages and less education. In recent analysis my colleagues and I conducted with a nationally representative survey, 13% of mid-career workers with just a high school degree reported having a non-compete. And that rate may itself be an underestimate to the extent that some workers are unaware of having a non-compete. Second, we have learned about the conditions under which workers sign non-competes. In one survey, roughly half of workers received an employer demand that they sign a non-compete on the first day of work or afterwards. It's therefore unsurprising that very few workers report that they have an opportunity to negotiate over the non-compete. And thirdly, we have converging bodies of evidence that enforceable non-competes have a negative impact on the wages of lower income workers. And all of this suggests that non-competes and the terms of their enforcement should receive very close scrutiny from policymakers. There are two key details of the bill under consideration today that I want to focus on. First, the income threshold, and second, the so-called garden leave provision. I'll close my remarks with just a few words on each of those. First, an income threshold for allowing non-competes is appealing given the core rationale for non-competes. That is, arguments for non-competes are often about protecting trade secrets that employers want to share with workers. And this is simply a less relevant rationale in the case of lower wage workers who are unlikely to work with trade secrets. And second, I think garden leave is appealing from an economic perspective because it requires employers to have skin in the game. If the non-compete is really necessary to protect vital employer interests like trade secrets, then the employer should be willing to compensate its workers for complying with a non-compete. And conversely, employers may not be willing to pay so much for non-competes that are abusive and only intended to limit worker bargaining power. So thank you again for the opportunity to speak today, and I would be happy to follow up with any information that the committee might find useful.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nunn. Next, we have Catherine Lyons, Director of Policy and Coalitions, the Economic Innovation Group.
Hi, present. Thank you.
Welcome. Please proceed.
Great. Well, good afternoon. Thank you to the chair and the members of this committee for the opportunity to testify regarding HF 999. I serve as the Director of Policy and Coalitions for the Economic Innovation Group, or EIG. EIG is a bipartisan research and public policy organization in Washington, D.C. that selectively engages in data-driven advocacy to advance economic dynamism and opportunity throughout the country. Non-compete reform is one of our priority issue areas. EIG supports HF 999, which would place effective constraints on non-compete agreements in Minnesota and rein in their harmful economic effects across the state. Non-compete agreements, as we've heard, were once reserved for executives and employees with access to trade secrets, yet they are now pervasive. Nearly one in five American workers have been subject to a non-compete. And as we've heard from fellow witnesses, a growing body of research demonstrates the harmful effects of non-compete agreements on worker mobility and wages, entrepreneurial activity, and the broader economy. In response, there is bipartisan consensus across the country for restricting the use and enforceability of these agreements. At the federal level, the Bipartisan Bicameral Workforce Mobility Act, which EIG supports, would ban the use of non-compete agreements for all workers except in a few narrow circumstances. This approach is already state law in neighboring North Dakota and Oklahoma and California, which attributes its world-renowned startup culture in part due to the unenforceability of non-competes. District of Columbia will soon join their ranks, and in 2020 alone, 17 state legislatures introduced legislation to limit the use of non-compete agreements. My colleagues have emphasized the benefits of reform for traditionally marginalized workers, so I'm going to focus my testimony on the deleterious effects of non-competes and what they have on the economy by hindering entrepreneurship and preventing the flow of knowledge that drives innovation and healthy competition. Not only do non-competes reduce startup activity, but they do so disproportionately for women, and companies that do start under strict non-compete regimes remain smaller and are less likely to survive. Higher earners are more likely to start high-growth businesses in innovation sectors, and more generally. With Minnesota's startup rate in the bottom one-third nationally, non-competes reform offers a rare opportunity to upgrade the state's startup ecosystem by encouraging more startups and spin-outs and empowering more Minnesotans to build the companies of the future right at home. So the time is ripe for reform. While we believe a near complete ban on non-competes at all income levels is the most effective approach to limiting harmful economic impacts and reaping the greatest benefits from reform, there are several policy levers that policymakers can adjust to limit the prevalence of these agreements. HF 999 incorporates many of the crucial components for reform. This bill would helpfully limit the scope of eligible workers to those who earn less than the median family income in the state. And even more critically, requiring that employers pay 50% of the worker's base salary during the restricted period in order for the agreement to be valid represents an important step in making non-competes resemble actual agreements rather than instruments of coercion. Furthermore, it creates a meaningful financial disincentive for employer overuse. Finally, the bill provides important legal protection to employees living and working in Minnesota from being required to resolve claims outside of the protection of state law. So in conclusion, HF 999 is a meaningful step to curbing the overuse and abuse of non-compete agreements in Minnesota and would result in a more dynamic state economy. EIG supports the passage of this legislation. Thank you again for allowing me to testify.
All right, thank you, Ms. Lyons. Next, we have Mr. John Reynolds, Minnesota State Director for National Federation of Independent Businesses.
Thank you, Chair John and members. I'm John Reynolds, State Director for the National Federation of Independent Businesses in Minnesota. NFIB is the state's largest small business organization with over 10,000 members, 75% of whom have fewer than 10 employees. When done properly, Minnesota courts have long agreed that non-compete agreements are a valid tool for protecting legitimate employer interests, such as confidential information, customer lists, and specialized training. A valid non-compete must not only protect a legitimate interest, it must provide compensation and be limited in duration, scope of activity, and geographic area, and an agreement signed post-employment must be accompanied by additional compensation. As stated in one of the resource documents provided to the committee by the bill author, quote, Minnesota has a well-developed body of case law in this area that is fair to both sides. With that, NFIB Minnesota has several concerns with House File 999. First, rather than address concerns about impermissible terms or frivolous enforcement, this bill allows well-funded companies to continue using non-compete agreements while making it harder and possible for smaller business and startups to protect the same interests. The bill invalidates non-compete agreements unless an employer can meet the financial threshold for their use, which puts small businesses and startups at a distinct disadvantage. As a result, many better resource firms will be able to afford to continue using non-competes to protect sensitive information, product development, and investment in worker training. Most small businesses will not. Second, the salary threshold in the bill, which would currently be about $78,000, is well above what most would consider a low-wage worker, which has been a target of non-compete reform in other states. Salary is undefined in the bill, but generally understood to mean fixed compensation, so the threshold does not include other forms of compensation, such as commission or bonus. This trigger is neither fair to employers or employees. Third, this bill fails to incorporate or address existing non-compete viability standards. It is unclear what this will mean for employers and employees in future litigation. And without direction to employers, employees, and courts in the bill's definition of non-compete agreement could leave confidentiality and non-solicitation agreements in limbo. Making it harder for small businesses and startups to compete does not help anyone in the long run. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Next, we have Jill Larson, Deputy Director, Deputy Executive Director for Minnesota Business Partnership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, hi, Jill. I see you. Could you state your name and you may proceed?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. I am Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Our members are the business leaders from many of Minnesota's largest employers. Our companies span across many industries, including manufacturing, healthcare, high tech, retail, professional services, and they employ about 500,000 workers just in Minnesota. Appreciate the opportunity to share some comments about the bill. We appreciate that the bill is not a blanket prohibition on all non-compete agreements, but we do have some concerns with the precedent the bill sets, as well as some of the specific provisions. Businesses use non-compete agreements to protect a company's intellectual property, confidential trade secret information, investments in developing customer goodwill, and other legitimate business and proprietary interests. And non-compete agreements are important to many Minnesota companies, companies that contribute enormously to Minnesota's economy. Reasonable non-compete agreements don't prohibit employees from earning a livelihood. Under current law, they must be of limited duration and limited scope. As was previously mentioned, Minnesota courts have developed over many, many years defined standards to determine the enforceability of these agreements. And they also have the authority to enforce non-compete provisions that are overbroad or if the employer doesn't have legitimate business interests. Courts also have the ability to actually rewrite unreasonable non-compete provisions. The analysis and the handout from the Federal Reserve and much of the discussion today has focused on lower wage workers. However, this bill applies far beyond those employees, including those with salaries up to approximately $95,000 per year. Now, I know a previous testifier said something of 70-something, but that I think household income is around that. Median family income, as prescribed in this bill, as far as I could tell, is around $95,000 per year for the employee, and it could be substantially more when non-salary income is added. So the exceptions to the prohibitions on non-competes in this bill we feel are narrow and arbitrary. For example, if an employee made less than the income prescribed in the bill, it could be a key employee, it could be an executive that has client relationships, that has proprietary information, and employers have a legitimate reason for wanting to protect that information, and that's why reasonable non-competes serve an important purpose. The provision about the garden leave requiring to pay 50% of an employee's salary is concerning, particularly if the non-compete isn't the reason that the former employee is not working during the restricted period. So we feel that the bill is a disincentive for businesses to locate or expand here to bring high-wage talent to Minnesota, and it could actually drive employers and businesses away from Minnesota. So again, appreciate the time to share some concerns with the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Next, we have Christopher Penwell. I see you're here. Could you please state your name and you may proceed?
Thank you. I'm Chris Penwell. I'm in private practice with the Siegel Brill Law Firm in downtown Minneapolis. I've been practicing almost 40 years. Non-competes are a major portion of my practice. Most of my practice, I have represented employers in the drafting and implementing and enforcing of non-competes. But in the last probably 5 or 6 years, I started charging a low flat fee to advise employees on their non-compete agreements. And I would say over the last 5 years or so, I've met certainly with hundreds of different employees, most of whom are leaving their job because their employment's been terminated or they're thinking about leaving their job. And they come and see me to try to figure out what it is that they signed however many years ago it was that they took the job when everything's rosy and they want the job and they're not so concerned about signing a non-compete at that point. the main thing that I found over the course of my practice is that non-competes simply aren't necessary to protect businesses. I want to make sure to differentiate non-competes from customer non-solicitation covenants. If I can't tell for sure if this bill covers customer non-solicitation covenants, but those are necessary to protect companies and should be preserved. But I just non-competes just aren't necessary. And it's not fair to an employee who maybe has been in a certain industry for 10 or more years to be told that for a year or longer, you have to leave that industry entirely and try to make the same amount of income in an industry that you don't have any experience in. So that's why I'm generally in favor of the concept. I don't know if the threshold amount is right. There need to be some other exceptions. A sale of the non-competes and the sale of a business are absolutely necessary. Highly paid executives who have competent legal counsel and negotiating power is another exception. There could be a severance payment. There could be stock options. So there are other contexts that I think need to be explored where covenants not to compete are appropriate. But again, as a concept, if it's that important to a company to have an employee completely out of that industry for a period of time, then they should pay them to do that. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Penwell. And then next on the list, we have Emily Olson. See, Emily's here. Could you please state your name and you may proceed with your testimony.
Welcome. Sure. My name is Emily Olson, and thank you, Chairman and the members, for listening to me. This last Friday, I was asked to testify about my experience with my non-compete. I am a independent contractor and former executive in the salon and spa world. And I'm here to let you know how it affected me. And it's a tough subject for me to talk about because it was really traumatizing. And I still have anxiety because of it. So please bear with me. Those were the worst years of my life. And because of my own trauma, I vowed to try and make a difference for others that were in my shoes. So I can say with confidence that today is one of the greatest days and the biggest honor of my career. So thank you for listening. I believe the best place to start is with the restrictions placed on the geographical location and the time period constraints and non-competes. I think there's a lot more that needs to be tackled, but that's what I want to talk about. I hope to be the voice that our industry needs, because I believe that we've been waiting to be heard for a long time. And, you know, I'm here to defend the right to pursue happiness. It's a simple notion. It's the right to pursue happiness is bestowed upon all of us by a constitutional guarantee. It's incumbent upon us as citizens to bestow that right upon each other. I want to tell you how the right to pursue happiness was taken away from me and thousands of other people in the salon and spa industry because of these clauses in the non-compete. The freedom to make career choices for myself and my family was taken away from me. Fortunately, I found my calling and career at 20 years old. And anyone that knows me will tell you that I always needed a challenge to be naturally set. And I set some lofty goals in my career so that I could provide guidance and leadership to peers and to be the future mother that I wanted to be. Unfortunately for me, my path to becoming a mother was not as easy as finding the right career. But due to the lack of time, I'll let you know I have a fantastic, amazing 12-year-old girl who is my little miracle baby. Going back, I moved up the ladder really fast at the salon that I chose to work at, and I was offered an executive position, and my title was to be the regional director of 4 salons. I would also be able to continue to perform services on my clients 2 days a week, so I was achieving all of my goals. Not long into my new role, I realized that both dreams of being a mother to an infant and a successful businesswoman could not coexist together. I needed to make the next move in my career. I had to leave, and I was terrified. I knew that by leaving, it would put me and my young family in financial ruin because of the strict non-compete. I had seen so many people attempt to leave before me, and I watched this non-compete destroy their lives. Before I could even find a job, I was served a cease and desist and sent many letters from their lawyer reminding me of what I signed through the next couple of months. It was at this point that my relationship with my daughter's father could no longer withstand the stress associated with the non-compete that was now controlling my life. It became clear that my former employer owned me. My non-compete stated that during 2 years, following my employment, I could not engage in employment within 25 miles of any of the locations. That was measured by driving distance. And for the record, that was all of the Twin Cities and even more of the greater surrounding areas. I should mention that I only did hair out of one of those locations. 25 miles from one location looks very different than all four when looking for a job. If I went more than 25 miles away from any of those locations, it would be taking an extra hour away from my child per day. Part of the reason that I stepped down from my regional director position. A quick note to touch on is the clientele that I had built up based on my $20,000 education and skill were not my clients. They were property of the salon. And if you let any woman out there know that, they become very horrified that they are not able to then follow their stylist. That should be their right. I do understand the right to protect a business. That part of my non-compete never expires. So this means I'm starting over with everything. The 11 years of building my career was down the toilet. I had to start at the bottom of the totem pole as if I just came out of school. That includes a paycheck that wouldn't even cover a week of groceries. How was I going to support a baby? The answer is I couldn't. I had to short sale my house. This is the house I brought my baby home to. With the cost of childcare, rent, food, diapers, gas, and now health insurance, I needed to find a safe place to rent, and it needed to be less than $900 a month. Many places will not rent to somebody after having a short sale. This was during the recession, when rent was at an all-time high. I was essentially homeless and facing being on welfare. I would look at my baby and just cry at the injustice of the situation that I was in, wondering, how is this legal? How can they get away with hijacking my career? How is this ever going to change? And I've been asked, couldn't you get an attorney invited? Guys, I couldn't put a roof over my head. Where was I going to find money to even get a small amount of advice from an attorney? And just when I thought things couldn't get worse, I got a bill in the mail for $10,000 for the epidural that didn't even work. But even if I had a little money to consult an attorney, the non-compete states that I also had to pay for the former employer's lawyer's fees. Many of the former employees did fight, but unless you had deep pockets, you will have to pay. I talked to many of them in the last couple of days. And between four of them, the total cost was $85,000+. So that means on average, would any of you pay $21,000 to start your career over after a decade of being there? There's no such thing as a lateral move in my industry. And as long as there is a period of time and a geographical area restriction in the non-compete, there is no way for us to succeed. It doesn't matter if it's 10 miles or if it's 20 miles. But to then make it outside all of the locations, when I worked at one, 2 years, I know that that wouldn't hold up in a court of law. But where was I going to get the money to fight it? Why drive 25 miles one way to work at a salon to work 2 years until I can find another job at a salon closer to home to work at? I have to start over again. So in closing, one of the best things as a parent that you can hear is when your child looks up at you with a big smile and says they want to be just like you and have the same job. And I smile at my daughter and I tear up because I want her to chase her dreams. And I fight the immense amount of pain that chasing my dreams caused me and my family because of a couple clauses in a non-compete. Does this seem logical or fair to you? Excuse me. Putting a restriction and distance on distance and the time frame together is monopolizing somebody's career and their ability to pursue happiness and make money. Our constitutional right is that we have the ability to pursue happiness. And it's your responsibility as part of the government to ensure that right. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you, Ms. Olson, and thank you for sharing with us here at the Capitol your personal story. Members, I'm going to ask for open up to the committee. Any questions or comments from members? All right, seeing none. Representative McDonald, I see you up there in the corner.
Thank you. I have a question for Representative Schultz. And I heard the testimony of Ms. Olson, and I understand that as a small entrepreneur and businessman myself, and having a photo studio, I've had over the last 34 years, I've had employees that just with a handshake and a not really a non-compete, but certainly a desire that they wouldn't learn what I have taught them over the years and then just open up a shop right next to the studio. So I understand the importance of non-competes. I understand that they can be too aggressive as well. I mean, as Ms. Olson said, 25-mile radius. So they can be pretty silly, actually, and unfair to the employees as well. But my understanding of the bill, Representative Schultz, is that if an employee is no longer employed at the company, usually it's a small business in this case that probably couldn't afford this bill, that they wouldn't, under your bill, the employer would have to pay them for a certain amount of time not to compete against them. Is that correct, Representative Schultz?
All right, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair and Representative McDonald. So if they wanted to use a non-compete agreement and their employee made over the median income, they could use a non-compete agreement, but they are basically saying that they would then, if that employee is terminated, they would pay half of their wages for 2 years. So that is correct, that if they wanted to use a non-compete agreement and they were eligible based on the income thresholds, they would then pay the employee because that employee would not be allowed to work in that same industry for 2 years.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you. So Representative Schultz, it appears to me that in doing some research on the bill and hearing your testimony, that this would really affect small family businesses. Your big companies like Medtronic or 3M, they most likely could afford to pay an employee or a former employee for a certain amount of time to make sure that they didn't give up intellectual securities or things that would harm their company. But this would really harm small family businesses. Businesses really couldn't really provide that economically. That seems very, very onerous and pretty wide stretching for encompassing all of Minnesota, that a small company would have to pay an employee for a limited time, a certain salary, not to compete after they're not even working. Doesn't that seem a little onerous?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative McDonald, I think there's an advantage to small businesses. If they do not wish to offer non-competes, they could attract maybe higher quality employees that aren't interested in signing a non-compete agreement. So they could have a market advantage on attracting employees and having a workforce. They can use other types of agreements like non-disclosure agreements. Trade secrets are protected. They do not have to have these very restrictive non-compete clauses.
Representative McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Schultz, I certainly agree that some of these non-compete clauses that are too far stretching are onerous as well. A 25, 30-mile radius, no compete. This would be very detrimental to small businesses. Absolutely. And I don't think I can support this bill. It would be very harmful. And is there any evidence, Representative Schultz, that this is happening in certain companies within Minnesota? Is this addressing one concern, one big company, or all encompassing Minnesota?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative McDonald, this affects multiple industries in Minnesota and multiple employers. This was drafted with myself, Nonpartisan House Research, and I worked with Professor Aaron Sojourner at the University of Minnesota Carlson School of Business, and he connected me to Professor Starr, and I was given very good language that I thought would work and be a compromise in Minnesota instead of completely eliminated the use of non-competes. I encourage you to talk to your colleagues in North Dakota and ask them if it's affecting their small businesses. My guess is that they eliminated them and are supported by all employers in that state.
All right, Representative McDonald.
Well, I would just close with this, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. I don't think it's the government's position to be meddling into contracts between employers and employees. I think that's left to the free market. And once government interferes, boy, I tell you, many, many troubles can ensue, especially in this non-compete clause that you have. So I think it'd be very detrimental to the economy and our smaller businesses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative McDonald. Representative Edelson, you're next.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Schultz. I just signed on as a co-author. I think this is a fantastic bill, and I just want
to... Oh, Representative Edelson, you are muted. Sorry.
Oh, can you hear me now? I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm about to...
Could you please repeat the last sentence?
Yes, thank you. I just... thank you, Chair. Representative Schultz, I just signed on as a co-author. I think this is a great bill. I want to thank you for bringing it. I think it's such an important thing that we think about how our demographics are changing. We are going to have a workforce shortage that will probably continue for years. And so the reality is these no-compete contracts that we're talking about today that you're addressing in these bills, they tie the hands of people with flexibility. Businesses need to adjust and they need to be good to their employees. I just want to thank you for bringing this. I think this is going to be a really good thing for our state. And I actually do think this is something our state should get involved with. So I would just thank you again.
All right. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Next on the list is Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions. The first one to the author of the bill. Can you describe when the separation payments would be made? Specifically, on page 2.10, it talks about the 50% of the employee's highest annualized base salary by the employer within the 2 years preceding the employee's. And then I've got specifically the question to point out is separation from employment. Can you describe the circumstances under which this particular part of the law would kick in? Because previously one of the testifiers said it would be when there was termination, and then we're utilizing the word separation. And what I'm looking for is what the intent is on the types of things that would trigger this type of a 50% payment by an employer.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Raleigh. So the language specifies that they would look 2 years preceding to look at how much salary would be the 50%. And termination, I think we should ask maybe Assistant Attorney General Mueller about the legal definition for termination. But my sense is that it's if they're terminated or they voluntarily leave. But I will defer to Jonathan Mueller.
Mr. Mueller. See here. Are you able to speak on this, Mr. Mueller?
Yes. Hello, Mr. Chair. Should I introduce myself or go straight into?
State your name. You can state your name and then you can proceed.
My name is Jonathan Mueller. I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I've served in the office for the last 8 years and have been practicing for 11.
It seems like there was a question directed at
Yes, I was going to get into that. So Minnesota law has several different statutes about payment of wages. One of them is about differentiates employees who are terminated. Although the statute uses the word discharge, not termination.
Mm-hmm.
And then it distinguishes discharge from employees who quit or resign. And discharge is covered in Minnesota Statute 181.13, and employees who quit or resign is covered in 181.14. So they are treated differently in the law. I hope that answers Representative Raleigh's question.
All right, Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this bill would cover which one, the termination, the separation, or both? That was literally the root of the question.
Mr. Moore?
I did not draft the bill. I'm not sure what Representative Schultz's intent was there. Just looking at it, it uses the word termination, mm-hmm. which to me suggests that it's not a voluntary change. But like I said, Minnesota law uses the word discharge versus quit or resigns for the other two statutes.
Representative Raleigh?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's exactly getting to the heart of the question. If we take a look at 1.10, it does talk about the termination. And then when we get into 2.10, it talks about the separation. And that's why I'm looking at what the difference is going to be between the two of them. And that was the root of the question. And then to the author, the second question that I've got is we've heard testimony on the variability of compensation. So because this bill is geared towards high value earners, people that are we're estimating between $75,000 and $95,000 is what I heard. And specifically it says, annual salary of the employer at least equal to the median family income for a four-person family. And so from the testimony that we've heard today, that's going to be between $75,000 and $95,000. Does that take into consideration the various tools and instruments that we use to retain high-value employees, such as stock options, tracking funds, things along that line? Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Raleigh. This just uses their annual salary, but I appreciate your questions. And, you know, this is the first hearing this bill has received. Yep. So I'm really open to input and working with you, Representative, on the language. And if you are open to using the word discharge, because termination also appears in line 2.5, mm-hmm. I would be happy to entertain a much more broader interpretation, not just termination, but voluntary and discharge. But right now, as stated, it's just their annual salary.
Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I don't have any other questions on that, but I am a small business owner. Starting up a business is tough. I was all in. I mean, you know, I put 100% of my life savings, my house, my credit cards, all of it all in order to make sure that, you know, I was providing an opportunity for my employees for the last 20 years now. And I've read through this bill, and I don't mean to be, I'm not trying to disparage it too much because I understand what you're trying to solve. I just don't think this is the right approach to it. As the author said, this is the first hearing. And I just can't support this bill as it is right now. I do want to have a conversation with you, Representative Schultz. I do look forward to that. I'm just not sure how to fix it in its current state, but I will think about it. But at this time, the way that it's written, I just can't support it as an employer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, next on the list is Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Schultz, for bringing this bill. I will say that my personal experience with this is, as a lawyer, especially a younger lawyer at a firm, lots of times people in your life will come to you when they have questions or contracts that they don't understand, and they don't really understand how it applies to them. And I have had more than a few people, I think, have the experience that I think that Ms. Olson was alluding to, which is they may actually be non-competes that are unenforceable if the courts took a look at them. I had a friend's kid who worked at Jimmy John's and had that very illegal non-compete agreement, which I think led to a legal settlement. But and in all sorts of, and particularly lower wage jobs, we've seen contracts that have that language, and language that it's pretty clear that when I look at, a court would not enforce. But that is little, it is little comfort to somebody who doesn't have, if you're, the ability to go get a lawyer, to make it worth it to that lawyer and to litigate their rights. And so, you know, a lot of this has to do with the power of workers to be able to do, you know, work their job, do what they need to do, go someplace else if they need to go someplace else. And the real purpose of the non-compete is about, you know, a set of workers, high-skilled workers, looking at how to protect some of that. But that's not where we've seen the most abuse. And so I really appreciate, I do think that as a legislature, it's our obligation to step in and say it is not an equal bargaining front. Employers are not, or employees in many cases are not negotiating these employment contracts, right? They're just take it or leave it. I both appreciate the testifiers, but I just think we should all sort of look into our lives and say, what good is that common law protection if folks can't enforce it? And so really appreciate this. One of the questions I had was about that, which is, I think a lot of this is really helping sort of vindicate vindicate's not the right word, helping employees actually have access to the legal rights that currently the courts give them. And I know that Attorney General Ellison alluded to that a little bit in his testimony that sort of the standard that currently exists. But I'm wondering if maybe the Assistant Attorney General can just sort of expand on that, about what currently are the parameters around the standards and how this relates to that.
All right, Mr. Moeller.
Yes, Chair, I'd be happy to answer. The most recent Minnesota Supreme Court case discussing non-competes is Kallick v. Medtronic, Inc. The citation is 573 NW2D 356. And it talks about that in Minnesota, non-compete agreements are looked upon with disfavor, but are enforceable if they serve a legitimate employer interest and aren't broader than necessary to protect the interests. The case instructs courts who are looking at non-competes to balance the employer's interest in protection from unfair competition against the employee's right to earn a livelihood. And the court basically decides if the employer's interest predominates, then it's valid and enforceable. If the employee's interest predominates, then it's not enforceable.
Representative Green.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Mueller. That was, I think, really helpful. And I think it's a good indication of, if you think about how our court system works, that may make sense as a process when we're talking about people who make $500,000 a year and are working in sort of med tech or whatever. That is not a system that is accessible to folks who are making, you know, 70, 50, 20. And so I just really appreciate the thoughtfulness of this policy that really is about looking at the places where we have workers who are not in the same bargaining position and making sure that we are protecting their ability to make a living and to thrive and to negotiate. So thank you, Representative Schultz, and thank you for the testifiers.
All right, thank you, Representative Greenman. Seeing no other hands, I will make one final comment and we'll hand it over to Representative Schultz for any final comments. I just want to thank the testifiers and also for Mr. Olson for sharing your personal story. I had a working mother, 8 siblings. She raised all 8 of us. And I do remember, you know, being a woman, a young woman with children, also not speaking English that well, difficulty. Even when they are wrong, you don't have the language skills to get the support. Who's going to know to talk to an attorney, right? And so I really appreciate you taking the time to join us. And I look forward to seeing this bill in the Judiciary Committee. And I'll hand it off to Representative Schultz for any final comments.
Well, thank you, Chair Zhang. And I really appreciate the comments around equity and how this is an equity issue, because even someone making $95,000 or $100,000 for a family of four may not have the economic resources to seek out legal advice. So it is really an equity issue. And many people sign these agreements after they've been offered and accepted a position. And so they're in a very difficult spot when they've already accepted it and now they're given this agreement to sign. So I really appreciate all the help I've received in drafting this legislation. And I really, really do appreciate all of the time the testifiers have given today. And I know Professor Starr is even on vacation, so thank you for being with us. But we've heard some really expert advice and input on from economic research that shows that this really impedes free labor markets. So even though another legislator, I think Representative McDonald, suggested that we need to let the free market work and not have government intervention, these agreements impede free labor markets. And I did hear a lot of support for maybe looking at low-wage jobs and not allowing these non-compete agreements. So I look forward to working with my Republican colleagues to find out what they will support in legislation so we can move something forward this year. But again, really appreciate the testifiers and hope that they can join me in the next committee stop, which is Judiciary.
All right, I will renew my motion that House File 999 be referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Mr. Petrie, please call the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer. Representative McDonald.
No.
No. Representative McDonald, no. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
No.
Representative Bliss, no. Representative Edelson.
Yes.
Representative Edelson, yes. Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
No.
Representative Poston, no. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, no.
Representative Raleigh, no. Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Sundin, yes. And Representative Detmer. Mr. Chair, we have 8 ayes and 4 nays.
Kevin, can you try that again? Representative Detmer just was, needs to unmute himself.
I said no.
Oh, Representative Detmer, no.
Can we get the count again?
There are 8 ayes and 5 nays.
All right, there being 8 ayes and 5 nays, the motion is passed and will be referred to the Judiciary Committee. And next up, we have House File 961 from Chair Eklund. All right, and Chair Eklund, please move your bell and introduce it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 961 be, I think it goes to Ways and Means, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, to Ways and Means, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a author's amendment.
All right, would you like to move your author's amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the A-10 amendment and brief introduction. The A-10 amendment, what it does is it pulls out the bonus pay that we tried to get for the supervising officers last year that was similar to what was happening with the conservation officers and the highway patrols. So it removes that section, the pay section of the bill.
All right. Motion from Chair Eklund. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? All right, your motion is adopted. Please proceed, Chair.
Representative Eklund, you are muted.
Chair Eklund, you're muted.
Look at there. You'd think after 2 years we'd get this figured out. But anyway, maybe Representative Raleigh can help me with my IT issues at some point in time. Anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 961. Most of the committee should be familiar with this. We saw it last year. It's a bill that authorized the law enforcement supervisors to form a collective bargaining unit. As of now, state law enforcement supervisors spread out over three different groups: the commissioner's plan, the managerial plan, and the middle management association. This bill does not mandate that all supervisors organize, but rather creates a bargaining group should their classification group choose to do so. This bill addresses the need for law enforcement to bargain separately, especially supervisors, due to state law enforcement losing ground over city and county law enforcement equivalents. The bill also allows supervisors to remain competitive with the bargaining group that represents the employees they supervise. Over the past 10 years, supervisors have lost ground and have not been afforded the same benefits of line employees. Lastly, this bill allows for employers to take some control over their future decision and have the opportunity to bargain for an equitable. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Van Voorhis to explain some more details of the bill.
All right, Mr. Van Voorhis, please proceed. State your name and for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, members. My name is Paul Van Voorhis. I am a 25-year veteran of the Minnesota State Patrol. I currently serve at the rank of lieutenant, and I am the president of the State Patrol Supervisors Association. My understanding is that the handout was given to you in your packets, but I'd like to go over that handout just briefly to give everyone a clear understanding of what's happening in state law enforcement. Are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Very good. So let's start on the very bottom. The very bottom of the screen is a depiction of the current line officers that Representative Eklund referred to. These officers include state troopers, conservation officers from the DNR, agents from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and then agents from the Department of Commerce, the Department of Corrections, and then the Department of Public Safety's Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement. Those units, if you will, all belong to the Minnesota Law Enforcement Association. They are organized, they bargain for themselves, and unionized. What this bill specifically looks at is the supervisors who are above them. So if we look on the far left, the Minnesota State Patrol supervisors are represented in the classifications of lieutenants, captains, and majors. To the next row, you see in green the lieutenants from the DNR. Those four groups are in what's commonly referred to as the commissioner's plan. It's a working plan. It's not an organized union by any stretch, but we fall under that plan for things such as wages and benefits, etc. Back to the DNR captains and majors, they're in a third group. They're in what's called the manager's plan. Which is similar, but not exactly the same as those that are in the commissioner's plan. So for example, if you look at the captains of the DNR in green to the captains of the state patrol, they're very similar, but they have different benefits and they're paid differently. They have a different pay wage, they earn vacation differently. So there are some stark differences. Moving over to the right, you have special agents in charge of the BCA agents, and then the special agents in charge of commerce, corrections, and alcohol. They are in a bargaining group, the Middle Management Association, as it currently stands. What this bill would do was create an 18th bargaining unit or organizational group that would encompass all of those supervisors if they so elect. Representative Eklund referred to it. One of the items or the line items in this bill isn't to force anyone into this bargaining plan, but rather allows them the opportunity to come over to the plan. So for a lot of the same reasons that Representative Eklund talked about, no one in this call is going to disagree with me when we say that law enforcement at this juncture in our history is at a very difficult position. One of the things that I'll share that Representative Eklund didn't share is that when the governor deploys state troopers, conservation officers, BCA agents to these events around the state that are contentious, or whether it's civil disobedience, the supervisors in those respective agencies are getting the job done. While yes, the line item, the line officers, of course, are carrying out those plans, the supervisors are the ones that are held responsible. They're the ones that are putting plans together, and as equally are the ones that are scrutinized the most. So organizing this group of law enforcement supervisors is going to afford us some additional protection that we currently don't have. A lot of the organizations on that list have associations like the State Patrol Supervisors Association that pools our money together to protect our members from frivolous lawsuits. Now, a lot of those lawsuits, of course, are protected if the supervisor is acting within the scope and the policy of the department. But some of the stuff that has come at us the last 2 years has been something I've never seen before. So pooling our resources together, bargaining fairly together, and we're all likewise situated to make it an equal playing field is really the intent behind this bill. And I thank Representative Eklund for carrying this bill. He's been a tremendous supporter, and I would stand for questions.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Van Voorhis did a good job explaining it, so we'll see if there's any member questions.
All right. Members, any questions or comments? Seeing none, Chair Eklund, any final comments?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll renew my motion that this bill be referred to Ways and Means, and I think it's a good bill. Appreciate no member questions. I think we had quite a few last year on it, and we're just fixing it up. And I'll let you know that it is moving in the other body. There has been that question in other committees. So, with that, Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
All right, Chair Eklund renews his motion that House File 961 be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Petrie, please call the roll.
Chair Eklund.
Yes.
Chair Eklund, yes. Representative Zhang.
Yes.
Representative Zhang, yes. Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Representative Detmer, yes. Representative McDonald.
McDonald, yes.
Representative McDonald, yes. Representative Berg.
Yes.
Representative Berg, yes. Representative Bliss.
Yes.
Representative Bliss, yes. Representative Edelson. Representative Frederick.
Yes.
Representative Frederick, yes. Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Representative Greenman, yes. Representative Nelson.
Yes.
Representative Nelson, yes. Representative Poston.
Yes.
Representative Poston, yes. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, yes.
Representative Raleigh, yes. Representative Sundin.
Yes.
Representative Sundin, yes. And Representative Edelson. Mr. Chair, we have 12 ayes and 0 nays.
Seeing 12 ayes and 0 nays, Chair Eklund, your bill is on its way to Ways and Means. And I think Chair Representative Edelson was in another committee presenting that bill. So, any further questions or comments from members? Seeing none, our next meeting will be tomorrow, Wednesday, February 23rd. We currently have 2 bills and an additional information hearing on the agenda. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.